Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to Quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you save on auto insurance for driving safe with USAA Safe Pilot, you'll feel like a big deal. Even in a traffic jam. Save up to 30% with USAA Safe Pilot. Restrictions apply.
Mike Evans, journalist, author, and musician, welcome. We're going to talk about your book, The Who, Much Too Much. But I want to start with you and just sort of get an idea about where and when you were brought up and what sort of music your parents played and when you rebelled against that and what sort of music did you listen to?
Okay. Well, it was a classic 1950s kind of childhood. I was born in the dark ages in 1941. So I'm about the same age as Pete Townsend. but my parents listened to all the predictable kind of pop music of the 1940s. You Are My Sunshine and If You Were the Only Girl in the World and all that kind of stuff. My dad was a bit of a crooner when he got up at the Working Man's Club, you know. So he used to sing all that stuff. But I had no musical. I remember I had piano lessons for about 5 minutes. I got so fed up with playing these scales. But this is when I was about 7 years old that I gave up, which I regret ever since, of course, because a piano's a wonderful introduction to things. And then I first rebelled against, as with most of us in that era, when rock and roll arrived, but not just rock and roll, because jazz, even though it'd been going for donkey's years, jazz hit that teenage mainstream at the same time with a lot of people. And so I was kind of simultaneously excited by jazz, rock and roll, and the crossover of skiffle, which again, hundreds of people were, millions of kids in Britain particularly. So I got involved in a skiffle group, learned four chords in each key, and thrashed about with that for a year or two. Excuse me. And so by that time, by the time you got to the end of the 50s, the rock and roll thing had faded. It was kind of Fats Domino, Little Richard, all that had kind of left the charts. And pop music was Cliff and the Shadows and... So we're all very snobby, and John Lennon wants to call me a jazz snob because I didn't.
I mean, I'm a bit younger than you, but I remember when I was a teenager. For me, Bowie was, you know, the biggest figure in, you know, yes, I was a teenager, yes, in like 1972, yeah, yeah. 73. Yeah. But he represented more to me than just music. He represented a sort of other society,
absolutely,
which I could belong to.
Yes.
And get, yes, away from my parents' society, as it were, and sort of go into a different world. Was there a figure for you that represented the other, where you wanted to go to and where you were not at as a child?
Yeah, there was. And of course, it was like fantasy land, because by the time you were a committed jazz fan or American folk music fan, because of the skiffle thing, your heroes were mainly American black men. So it was even more, it was even more removed from the experience in North Wales, where I came from. So your heroes were like, your heroes were Ray Charles, and used to go around with shades on that wrapped around like that, you know, and talking kind of beatnik slang, you know, the Beats were the other kind of heroes, the writers. So you kind of talked in beatnik slang and said, yeah, man, and let's split, you know, all this stuff.
How did you get into a band, though?
So I was a bit late. I was a bit late in all that. I'd done the kind of skiffle thing and never pursued that particularly much, the guitar. And I went to London to college. For some reason, I just acquired very cheaply a battered old saxophone, just because I fancied it, you know, because I was a dyed-in-the-wool jazz fan by then. But the interesting thing was that simultaneously in London, this was 61, 62, the R&B thing was starting at the Marquee. And I was at Regent Street Polytechnic, which is about 5 minutes walk from the Marquee. So we used to go. So this was like our local club. And every Tuesday night, or was it Thursdays, Alexis Corner had his R&B nights. And Alexis was the kind of melting pot for that very early English R&B boom. So his drummers were Charlie Watts, Ginger Baker, his bass player was often was Jack Bruce, and so on. So these were the kind of unknowingly the foundations of the, and the Stones used to get up and play occasionally, or parts of the Stones. And so this is like an amazing scene. And then simultaneously in Liverpool, because I had a girlfriend in Liverpool by this time, so I used to hitchhike up and down to Liverpool. Simultaneously in Liverpool, the Beatles were playing at the Cavern, and neither the twain should meet. You see, nobody knew about the other one. And I was kind of party to both these things. And Pete Brown, who was already quite well known as a poet, became a mate of mine. And he said, I said, I need to get some sax lessons. And he said, well, I'll introduce you to Dick Extall-Smith, who played with Alexis. So we met in a pub one night, and Dick had this weird guy with him, this ginger head, very cropped, short hair, called Peter Baker, who of course was ginger. And so that's how I met Dick. And I say simultaneously in Liverpool, the Beatles were playing at the Cavern. And I remember one lunchtime at a Cavern session. The bands were quite accessible to the kids in the audience then, because there was a stage, there was a some chairs, and then at the back there was a kind of little coffee bar which just sold coffee, Coke, and hideous Cavern soup. And this is lunchtime sessions, and so the bands would come and mingle with the kids, getting a Coke or something, you know. And so I collared Lennon and said, have you heard about this R&B thing going on in London? He said, no, what's that? You know, I said, oh, I said, you want to hear it, man? I said, it was a big double page spread in the Melody Maker last week. And he said, the Melody Maker, that's for fucking jazz fans. He said, jazz snobs. I only read the NME.
But what's fascinating about, you know, I mean, you write a book about The Who, but you actually performed on the same stage. You supported The Who in your band.
My first band was a rhythm and blues soul band called the Clayton Squares, which played support to a lot of people, but I don't think that included The Who. But when I know we played with The Who was when I was in a band called the Liverpool Scene, which is a kind of poetry, late 60s poetry come music band, you know. And in those days, all that kind of stuff was mixed up, you know, you could do anything. So, you know, we toured, we were the support with Led Zeppelin's first UK tour, you know, this poetry band, it's like madness. So, so a bit of Liverpool Scene, we played with The Who several times. So you did get to know them. And then I kept in contact with, bizarrely, later in life with Townsend briefly, because I worked for a few years at the Musicians Union as their kind of rock music man. And Pete was very keen on that. He's keen on kind of musicians getting a better deal and, you know, that kind of thing. So he used to kind of voice his support from time to time for what I was doing with the union. And then I remember one night in the late 60s, actually, in the Speakeasy Club, I was with Roger McGough, the poet, and he introduced me to Keith Moon, who was just sitting at the end of the table, you know. So he had this evening drinking with Keith Moon, who then took me over and said, "Have you met Jimmy?" And it was Jimi Hendrix, who just hit London, you know. He was this young guy, you know. So, but all that was kind of part of the course at the time. You didn't think anything historic about it. It was just, yeah, okay, man, you know. And it's only in retrospect that these things have any significance, you know what I mean?
You were never tempted to smash up your saxophone on stage then?
No. It cost me too much. The good one did.
You mentioned Led Zeppelin, but you jammed with them one performance. Tell me about that.
Well, we did this short British tour, which was their first UK tour, about six or seven venues. Usual Bristol, Birmingham, Manchester. And then ending up at the Albert Hall on Sunday night, in the beginning of some week of concerts called the Pop Proms. So the opening night of this Pop Proms was the last night of the Zeppelin tour. And so it was on the Albert Hall, and we used to kind of occasionally jam with them in the band room anyway, just when you're all getting tuned up, you know, 12-bar blues kind of thing. And so we decided to, they said, there was another band on as well called Blodwyn Pig, and they had a sax player as well. So one of, it was probably Jimmy Page, said, "Do you want to get up on Long Tall Sally as like an encore when we finished our set? Because the two saxes would suit it very well, you know." So we said, yeah, okay. So that was it. So we kind of just did this jam at the end of their last set, you know, their last concert on this thing.
So why did you become a music journalist? How did that sort of morph into being a music journalist and then writing books?
Alan Williams, the famous man who gave the Beatles away, had stumbled across some tapes of the Beatles playing in Hamburg, some tapes of them at the Star Club in Hamburg in 62. He'd stumbled across these dusty tapes and said, he phoned me up, he said, "Oh, I saw you in the Manly Maker last week. Do you do anything for them?" And I said, "Well, not really." He said, "Well, you want to hear these tapes?" So he played me these tapes. They're like quite remarkable. So I phoned up Ray Coleman and said, "Do you want a piece about these? I'll write a piece about these tapes." And he said, "Yeah, okay." So he did this big full-page thing about the forgotten Beatle tapes and so on. So that's how I got into that, really. And then the Melody Maker, they had a string of freelancers around the country, which the other pop papers didn't. So if a tour, say an American tour, started off in Newcastle or Liverpool rather than kicking off in London, which they often did as a kind of testers, the Melody Maker would beat the enemy to the review, because they'd phone up their man in Liverpool or their man in Newcastle. They had a string of freelancers. So I was their man in Liverpool for a while.
So let's come to the book, because you know, I presume either you put into the publishers, "I want to write a book about that," or they come to you and say, "We'd like a book about this." I don't know which way that happened, but I'd like to know what your first thoughts were about how you wanted to structure the book and how you wanted to approach it.
Well, as with lots of things in publishing, they come out of not some brilliant idea out of the sky by the author or the publisher, but often just a result of conversations. And with all those bands, you know, the Who, the Beatles, Bob Dylan, there's so much out there, you think, oh, you can't do anything else. And I was just thinking, well, the only thing I don't remember seeing, and I'm sure there's one out there somewhere, was in the fashion that they were planning to do these books, was a book about the Who linked by the albums. So another biography of the Who, but making the albums the signposts. And there hadn't been a decent book of the Who for some time. And every couple of years, Pete and Roger Daltrey would get together again and in some formation or another. So there was a kind of bit of continuity about it up to the present day, even though it's fairly nebulous, you know, because you never know when the next one, if there's going to be a next get together. But they they did bring out the album called Who, just before, you know, not long before we finished the book, so that was included. So it just seemed a decent idea to develop, you know, and that was it.
I mean, I really find it fascinating that the foreword, which is written by Keith Outham, it really sets up the book really nicely, because he tells, he was a publicity manager, I think, for 16 years, from 71 to 87 or something. And he tells his story of when he was 16 and interviewed the band and what happened. Can you tell me about that? Because I think it sort of sets up what's to come in the book, and really the idea of who they were and sort of how outrageous and how their sort of interpersonal relationships come out in that small foreword.
Yeah, well, that's right, because he chanced upon them in that period when they were, you know, more anarchic than they were later. As you say, it encapsulated the fact that putting a rock band together in those days was at least 50% of it was for a laugh. You know, it wasn't for some musical ideal, or not like the R&B bands where you were trying to, you know, like the early Fleetwood Mac wanted to be, you know, what's his name, Jeremy Spencer wanted to be Elmore James. You know, they had this vision, you know, it's a great vision, which they may or may not have achieved. And even though in their earliest manifestation, the Who too were an R&B band. And, you know, they did a couple of R&B numbers on their first, I mean, numbers they hadn't written on their first album, for instance. This is Bo Diddley, I'm a Man, or whatever. So they were clearly into that area of music, but they weren't dedicated in that way that they were kind of po-faced, serious bluesmen, or wanting to be serious bluesmen. And so the 50% doing it for a laugh was probably 90%. It keeps moving to case, you know. It's, but they were all good. That was the point. It's one thing. That's where the kind of punk ethos fell to pieces, really. The punk ethos was you weren't taking it too seriously, but at the same time, you didn't bother about doing it very well. whereas they were all good musicians in their own way, you know, in a kind of unschooled, if you like, in terms of formal training, as unschooled as the punks were.
They were all brought up in post-war Britain, a bit like yourself. But they had quite different childhoods, didn't they? Can you tell me what the differences were between them as they were growing up?
Well, Pete certainly had a fairly unique childhood, because both his parents were at significant points in their lives were professional musicians. His dad was in dance bands, and his mother sang with dance bands, usually different dance bands, hence a lot of friction in the family. You know, she so that was a very musical background, if you like. Whereas the others were all from fairly modest backgrounds, but they weren't. I don't think they were particularly musical in that sense.
But did that mean, you know, you said that, you know, people just sort of fell into the idea of going into, you know, this is a good idea, I'm going to be in a band, but not really actually thinking about what they wanted to achieve. But was that the difference between Pete Townsend and the rest, because Pete actually had this background, and also he had a different education, didn't he, as well? So was there a difference in their ambitions, really, in that way?
I suppose so, yeah. But then again, the music by that time was a great leveler, you know, and it was a bit like the art school thing. You know, Pete was at art school, and the art school was another great leveler, because kids from the old grammar school system and kids that went through the secondary mod schools and all that, they could often end up at art school, whereas they wouldn't end up at university. And it was, hence a lot of rock and roll players or blues players or whatever came out of the English art school system, including all the famous ones we know about, you know, Ray Davies, John Lennon. So I think that was a great leveler. And so the kind of enthusiasms that you had as a teenager, combined with fairly, for want of a better word, bohemian kind of attitude to life in general, was a sort of leveler in a way.
I mean, there were essentially two bands that came together, and then Keith Moon was the addition. What changed when Keith Moon joined to really make them the Who? What changed?
Yeah, that's right. Because there was the Detours, and we became the Detours.
Yeah, there was the Squadronaires, wasn't it?
That's right.
Squadronaires, yeah. I should say. Yeah,
they were unlikely, as you say, they were unlikely musical allies, but it just worked.
When did they become mods, and why did they become mods?
Well, with Kit Lambert and particularly and Chris Stamp, their original managers, those two characters were very aware of kind of had their button on trends and teenage fashion, probably more than the Who did, you know, in terms of just as observers. So they were in this kind of environment where they were becoming aware of their image. Pete with his smashing the guitar thing, which originally astounded Kit Lambert and Chris Stamp, they originally attracted them. He got that from art school. He got this notion of auto-destructive art and all these kind of fancy ideas. And whether he first broke a guitar out of temper and then said, oh, this is auto-destructive art, or the other way around, is open to debate forever. I think it's probably the former, you know, he probably fucked this, and then later on said, oh, that's a good idea. And of course, they thought it was worth including in the act, the managers did, because they were very aware of the visual side of things. So I think it was all that. And then pop art, of course, which tied in with the American pop artists and Targets and Symbols and Union Jacks and Stars and Stripes, all that was brought in on the pop art level. And mod, for want of a better word, mod culture just adopted all these things, like in the same way that why did mods adopt Italian scooters, you know what I mean? Particularly, I mean, the Teds didn't have Italian scooters, or the Rockers didn't have Italian scooters. What, you know, what's this all about? So they're just kind of like all these teenage things, they come from all sorts of angles and they just adopted them. And the Who adopted the pop art thing, and it coincided very well with the start of Ready Steady Go, the TV program, because if you remember, the sets on Ready Steady Go were all kind of pop arty, arrows and road signs and things. And I remember a mate of mine who is not quite a famous photographer, called Clive Arrowsmith, but at the time he was at the Royal College, and I bumped into him one day in a pub in London. I said, "Oh, Clive, what are you doing these days?" And he said, "Oh, I'm at the Royal College." I said, "Oh." He said, "But we've got a great job on the side. They've recruited some of us to paint sets for this new TV program." So it was these guys from the Royal College who were doing the sets for Ready, Steady, Go. And of course, the Who completely coincided with that. The first TV show, I don't know if it was Ready, Steady, Go, but it was the first time they prominently appeared on TV. And they became like almost the house band. They were on there more often than anybody else. I've got a book here about Ready, Steady, Go, and they far outstripped any other bands for the times they were on it, you know.
There's a great story about Jimmy Page and him being in the studio when they were initially recording, and then him being on, was he on I Can't Explain on one of the early tracks?
Oh, yes. Yes, he was, because I think it was... There was one track where they refused to have him on it because he'd just done the day before, literally, or no, it was a hit, but he'd just done it. It had gotten to the charts the day before. You Really Got Me by the Kinks. And he played that guitar solo. And And so they used to, because he was just a session man, who was also an R&B player, because he played in the Yardbirds and so on. But they were, he was like a house rock and roll kind of session player. If they needed a funky guitar solo, they'd phone up Jimmy. And so he was just in the studio at the time, and they rode him in. So I think it was, I can't explain, because it was the first time. Yeah, that's right. And they rode him in to do this guitar solo, and Townsend would have nothing of it, you know. He said, "I'm not having this guy playing, you know, we do it ourselves, we don't do it at all." And so he actually didn't play on that. I think he played on the flip side.
Why were so many bands during the 60s the victims of corruption and bad management and ended up with very little money? Why did that all happen during that period, do you think?
And obviously it was more conspicuous when you're doing quite well. I mean, if you had suddenly had a hit record in the charts and you were still making 25 quid a week, you'd start to question it, whereas we didn't have any hit records in the charts, so making 25 quid a week or what it was didn't seem too bad, you know what I mean? You just got on with it. But all those, a lot of those characters around, it was, the whole system was screwed. It wasn't just individual villains like Don Arden, but there were actual, you know, it was just the way the whole thing was structured. The contracts were all weighed in favor of the managers or the record company or whoever the contract was with. They made sure that any advances, not just advances, but say advances on tours. If you're doing a tour and you're a costly tour, the band footed all the bills, you know. So even though it's promoting an album by that time, you know, if you're an albums band later in the 60s, the whole thing was kind of weighed towards the business rather than the musicians. That's one reason why in the 70s I got involved in the MU, in the Musicians Union, for precisely that reason.
Well, what I found really interesting about the book is that because you're going through the albums and you go through, like, you know, the album, first album, My Generation, and you see the track My Generation, you think, wow, this is such an iconic song, and they had many iconic songs, but they weren't actually that successful at that point, were they?
No, that's right. What, you mean the band was, or the song wasn't?
No, the band weren't.
No, that's right. They. I mean, commercially, their biggest success was in the era of the album, the kind of late 60s album era, you know, via Tommy. And after that, when they became a stadium band in the States, whereas stadium bands didn't exist in the 60s. You know, the nearest thing you got to a stadium band was the Beatles playing at the local Odeon, you know, rather than the Cavern.
Yeah, but what's fascinating is that in retrospect, you see it very differently. You look back that and you say, wow, that, you know, that's the moment or something. But yes, it wasn't the moment.
No, you're quite right. It was all kind of half of the course at the time. I mean, My Generation was a...
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
A great track and a great single when it occurred. But it was just one of, looking back in perspective, it was just one of many great singles that seemed to be coming out in, you know, 1965.
Be a barbecue hero with delicious, ultra-low net-carb Hero Bread buns and tortillas. Soft and fluffy, high in fiber, and with 0 grams of sugar, up to 10 grams of protein, coming in at under 100 calories per serving. Oh, and did I mention they taste like their mouth-watering traditional versions? I mean, what's not to love? Use code AH10 for 10% off your first Hero Bread purchase at Hero.co. That's AH10 for 10% off at Hero.co.
The United States Border Patrol has exciting and rewarding career opportunities with the nation's largest law enforcement organization. Earn great pay, outstanding federal benefits, and up to $20,000 in recruitment incentives. Learn more online at cbp.gov/career/USBP.
We made USAA insurance to help you save. Take advantage of discounts when you cover your home and your ride. Discover how we're helping members save at usaa.com/bundle. Restrictions apply.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
How integral was Kit Lambert to the success of The Who?
Well, he had a kind of theatrical background. His mother was Constance Lambert. He brought the kind of, as I say, he was obsessed, or not obsessed, but he was fascinated by the visual side of it, the fashion side of things and so on. So I think he brought a kind of finesse to it, whereas Chris Stamp was a bit more of he was a East End working class lad, he was a bit more of a wheeler dealer. So he did that side of the business, you know, whereas Kit Lambert did the, for want of a better word, the creative side. And as a team, they worked very well, one kind of feeding off the other. But no, he was very important, as I say, and he harnessed Pete's kind of creativity, which could have been in other circumstances, if you didn't have somebody encouraging you from the outside, could have just got lost in the mists of time, you know what I mean? Some crazy idea that Pete might have, just the others might have said, oh, we're not doing that. It was, it just kind of got, you know what I mean? Yeah, it was a bit like the Beatles with George Martin, that he was able to focus maybe wacky ideas that they had musically into something that was both accessible but also very radical, you know.
How did Pete's lyrics sort of differ from the lyrics and the songs of the other great artists of the era, the Beatles, the Stones, and Led Zeppelin, and so on?
Well, not think of any particular songs, but they were a lot of them were fairly autobiographical. You know, not directly, but they were from his own experience or reflecting his own experience. My generation, I won't get fooled again, or these are kind of highly personal in the way that the Beatles, for instance, were much more out of the, I hate to say it, but they were out of the kind of love song Moon is June tradition, in the sense they were, you know, they sounded like they were first person, but they weren't talking about themselves, you know. Oh, she was just 17. Well, you don't know. Well, there was a girl who was just 17, you know. But it just, so they were able to kind of stand apart and be that teenager or be that young person. Whereas I think a lot of Townsends were a bit more of him, of himself. And the Stones, of course, were even further away from it, because they're able to, probably because they grow up as kind of rhythm and blues men, they're able to have an outside scenario that they described, you know.
I mean, art is often seen as compensation.
Like Mother's Little Helper or Painted Black. These were kind of, weren't necessarily from personal experience. They could have been, but they weren't necessary. They were much more focusing on a scenario that was out there.
Yeah, I mean, for Pete, was it about compensation? Was it about working through issues that he had in his childhood? Abuse was something that was in his childhood, wasn't it? Was it a way for him to work through those issues, do you think?
Well, yeah, I think it was, because he was quite an angsty kind of person, I think. And of course, at the time, in that rock and roll lifestyle, it could either aid that process or they could destroy you. You know what I mean? If you're the teenage angst going on, well, all you need added to that is a load of drugs. You can kind of kill you, you know. But at the same time, if you channel it or it becomes channeled in a more creative direction and you kind of handle it, then it can produce great songs, you know. But as I say, it's always hard to pin down.
Where did his fascination for the idea of creating a rock opera come from? Where was that base? I know he'd already written this, the 9 minute, A Quick One While He's Away,
right.
Sort of mini opera. But I just wondered, was that the trigger for him to create Tommy and Quadrophenia, or was that the, or was it, did it come from something else before that?
I think, like a lot of people, when they've suddenly got access to the magic of a recording studio, they have what my father would have called ideas above their station, you know. I think once you're introduced to that possibility that songs don't have to be, and of course it was the era of the album was beginning to take over. So the idea of a pop song didn't have to be 3 minutes, 4 minutes, which originated in the days of the 78s anyway. So suddenly you had the album track, which could be as many minutes as you wanted to the length of an album. And you had this kind of technical freedom, plus all the layers of technical gimmickry that was becoming available in the recording studio anyway. So there was kind of technical reasons why you might have these ideas above your station, which you wouldn't have had 10 years before. You know, when you were a pop band, you went in the studio, did what the producer said, and got out again and recorded your first album like the Beatles did in a day or something, you know, kind of. There was the kind of technical side that allowed you to allow these dreams to occur and these ambitions. And we've got half a side of an album left. Let's do a mini opera. Let's sling three numbers together, you know, whatever it might be. So I think it just came out of the environment. It allowed you this success. And you have to have that imagination, obviously. But it allowed you to indulge your imagination a lot more, you know.
I mean, he outlined what he was, you know, Tommy, and what he was going to do with Tommy before he'd actually done anything, didn't he? He'd outlined it in an interview with Rolling Stone.
That's right, yeah.
I mean, that's a, you know, there's a danger to that as well, isn't there?
I know. I've got this great idea. and it's the kind of thing where if you weren't, by that time, if you weren't your own boss in the studio, a producer, and certainly a commercially minded producer would say, forget it, you know.
So was there really problems in the studio between the band when he was developing that? Because the ideas, you know, I mean, he'd already put out his ideas in a way, and then he's going to go in the studio with the others. And I presume then conflicts can arise. So how was that process for the band?
One can only glean from what you read from various angles, but I think because they'd achieved, before they got to the point of Tommy, for instance, they'd achieved enough commercial success, mainly on the back of Pete's enthusiasms, to take it as a fair bet. If Pete said, we'll do this, they were quite happy to get along with it. I mean, Roger Daltrey, for instance, was, had he not been in The Who, would have been a straight down the line, would have been straight down the line, mid-60s rock singer, ended up on the cabaret circuit or something. You know, he's very straight, mainstream, not even mainstream in the kind of, when rock and roll became, or beat music became rock with a capital R, he wouldn't have even crossed into that division, I don't think. Whereas in the environment that Pete created or was the main creator of, he went, he was happy to go along with it because it was succeeding by then, you know. I mean, I think they had more arguments about style and so on earlier on, when it seemed to be some Pete's ideas were kind of seemed bizarre. And I think people like Keith Moon, as long as musically he could enjoy it, he went on with it. You know what I mean? It wasn't as if the music had shifted to something ultra complex or ultra staid or ultra serious. It was still the Who. You know what I mean?
You do have the feeling that Townsend couldn't have been Townsend without Daltrey, and Daltrey couldn't have been Daltrey without Townsend.
Absolutely, it's like Lennon-McCartney. Just like Lennon-McCartney, they were quite different. And had they gone off on their own route, it would have been quite different. No, absolutely.
I mean, you mentioned earlier that when you were in a band and you got married and had children, then that whole idea of touring and being on a stage and having that freedom that you can have changed. With them, it does seem like Entwistle and Moon needed freedom. And they lived for that moment to be on the stage.
Yeah,
Can you tell me about what you found out about that?
Well, lots of characters are like that. And I think it was purely that they found their creativity, for want of a better word, actually in that moment, and sitting in the studio, if you like, reproducing it again was a lesser thrill. Whereas with something like Townsend, the thrill was in the studio more than bashing it out on stage, seemingly the same every night when you could hear yourself with kids screaming, you know. So it was a different kind of dynamic for, you know, some rock and rollers are primarily performers and others are primarily people who do it in the studio, you know. Now, I mean, the Who were part of that process of that developing into that. I mean, for myself, it was just that I couldn't see that particular band conquering the world, you know what I mean? And so I wasn't going to kind of go back on the road for 2 years and all the kind of the discomfort as well as the comfort.
But there is a grounding when you have a family and they're not grounded. Yeah. And so how did that play into the, you know, eventual death of Keith Moon and the eventual death much later, of course, of John Entwistle?
Well, I don't know. I mean, whether it's the self-indulgence that one allowed oneself on the road, presumably that you know, Daltrey and Townsend had access to that just as much, but they were more grounded characters, I suppose, in their own way. It's who knows. I mean, all we've got to go on is the evidence, and a lot of it's kind of hearsay, obviously, the more outlandish evidence. But I don't think, this happens so many times in not just rock and roll, but in all sorts of artistic pursuits, you know, that why is one painter like a struggling genius who commits suicide, and another painter of the same level carries on till he's nearly 90, like David Hockney, you know. But, you know, it just happens, doesn't it? We can't, because they all came from the same environment, if you like. Well, similar environments, and the same enthusiasms and the same temptations.
I mean, there's many crazy and wild stories within the Who story. And one of them is their performance and Pete Townsend's reaction when they played at Woodstock a fan came on stage.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it wasn't a fan, it was Abbie Hoffman. I suppose he called himself a fan, but I mean, he was notorious as one of the yippies, the youth. I forget they called themselves something party. Anyway, it's just kind of radical. We know what it was, but he jumped on the stage and started kind of joining in on it, trying to, you know. And that's right. He joined on the stage and he started yelling about freeing John Sinclair, who is an activist who was in jail for some spurious. The police found him with half a joint or something, and he was in jail anyway. And I remember John Lennon did some B. John Sinclair things around the same time. But anyway, yeah, he started yelling in the middle of their set or between numbers about John Sinclair, and Townsend just like, who didn't have a great time for the hippies anyway, just literally flung him off the stage and bashed him with his guitar. And of course, at the time, it was great because Townsend was actually wearing this very anti-hippie clobber. You know, he had this white working man suit on and huge bother boots. You know, what the used to, later adopted as bother boots. And kicked him off the stage. So it's quite amusing.
What were the repercussions of that? Did it actually sort of play into them, into their sort of legendary status in a way as being sort of the wild men of rock?
Well, I think it did because on the one hand, the whole hippie thing was supposed to be, back in 1969, was still kind of revolutionary. And it's bad banner, if you like, was the Rolling Stone magazine. And suddenly this guy who had become one of the kind of mouthpieces via My Generation and all that, a bit like Bob Dylan, you know, Bob Dylan hated all that and famously beat that guy up that used to go through his dustbins, you know. They hated all that. Apparently, Dylan had a sign outside his house when he lived in Woodstock that said, if you ain't got an invite, you're not welcome, and a picture of a gun.
Yeah, very peace and love.
Yeah, so Townsend was kind of, if you like, of that kind of frame of mind. And of course, things like Rolling Stone wallowed in all that hippie thing at the time, they changed radically later. And so it's quite a kind of a shock thing that one of their mouthpieces, i.e. Abbie Hoffman, was thrown off the stage by another of their heroes, Pete Townsend, you know. But it did, as you say, extend their image as the wild men of rock into that fold as well. You know what I mean?
I mean,
the hippie bands were a fairly safe bet, you know.
In the mid 70s, when Tommy was filmed and Ken Russell came on board as the director, and this became a massive hit, I was trying to sort of look at where the turning point might have been for the band in terms of, you know, often a band is over before the official over. Do you know what I mean? And that the turning point comes at another era. Where do you think that was? And was that in relation to the massive success that Tommy had?
I think Tommy, and we'll never know this, obviously, but I think Tommy, the movie, was more of an indulgence or more of a vehicle, a sympathetic vehicle for Roger Daltrey. In a way, it fed into his kind of showbiz aspirations, if you like. Whereas I think some of the extravagances involved, the visual extravagance and the Bee Gees and all sorts of things, you know, I think that sort of wasn't really Townsend, you know what I mean? It wasn't Tommy as he originally. It was so exaggerated and over the top as all as Ken Russell things were. Whereas I think Daltrey, and we never know this unless you asked him face to face, I think he was probably more comfortable with what was going on, you know. It was much more show busy, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, totally. And I think, yeah, I can see that point. Yeah, that it's actually, yeah, that fits him much better. I mean, exactly. They obviously knew that Keith Moon was completely wild and drug obsessed, or whatever you want to call it. He was really into drugs. How much did they try and help him? And were they then not surprised by his death?
I think the problem with all that is that even though you might have one person in a band who's doing all that over the top, if the others are doing it to a kind of more manageable degree, then they don't really see the they don't see the problems more obviously than the outsider would. You know what I mean? Like if Keith Moon was completely out of it every night and couldn't play, then they'd see there's a problem. But while it was still working in terms of the band, and they'd be half out of it anyway, then it's only in retrospect that they can be clever enough to say, oh, well, I knew he was taking too much of this and doing too much of that. But at the time, you just kind of laugh it all off. I'm just finishing a book at the moment about Fleetwood Mac, which is, as it happens, not in the light of Christine's death. We'd started it way before that, but in the light of her death, that's obviously the last portion of the book changes. but doing that, and they were, you know, notorious in the studio of just sitting up all night sniffing coke and then starting to record about 3 a.m. when they were completely out of it. You know, this is on Rumours, you know, which is their greatest creation. But I mean, at the time, they were all doing it. So they didn't, you know, there was, you couldn't point the finger at one was doing it worse than the other. And then later in life, they obviously say, oh, you know, I don't know how we got through it and all that. They're quite honest about it. That particular crowd, you know, that it's, oh, I don't know how we got through it. But but at the time, you could see that if there was a Keith Moon there, they wouldn't have noticed. They just all at it, you know. So I don't think there's any, from what one gleans, if one of them was a bit more cautious about that, it was Mr. Professional. It was Daltrey. He'd go to bed before the others, you know, that kind of thing. Again, that tells you something, you know.
I mean, the 80s were
But Pete seemed as wild as Mooney on lots of occasions. And conversely, at that time I met Mooney in the thing, he was just half a pint of beer, you know, like... Have you met Jimmy? But it's like, you know, it's kind of like nobody is that out of it all the time, as they never work, you know what I mean?
Yeah. The 80s were a period where there was sort of the wilderness for them, in the sense that the stadiums had obviously gone when they're not with the band, and and having a different life. How did Daltrey and Townsend deal with that different life during that period?
Well, they all famously did their other projects, if you like. I mean, with Daltrey, it was partly just private things like his farm and his this, that, and the other. You know what I mean? He lives not far from here. I live in Hastings, and he lives just down the road near Rye. So they all indulge in their private lives, and creatively, obviously, Pete took off on quite a few, which we refer to in the book, various projects like the Lifehouse things and all that, that the other guys weren't involved in particularly, and then they would occasionally. Less occasionally as time went on, and especially after Entwistle had died as well, occasionally they'd get together if the occasion occurred. And often now it's just special things like Daltrey's teenage cancer thing, which for a while was a big concert every year. They still do it, but often not with his performance. They don't get the Who together for that. They still have an annual teenage cancer's big concert in Hyde Park or somewhere. You just don't happen to have the Who doesn't get together for it every year, you know.
What do you think the legacy of the Who can be said to be today in retrospect, in the way that they may have influenced the artists or genres that came after them?
Well, immediately, as I said before, they influenced punk. I mean, physically influenced it in the sense of the way they played and the kind of the dynamic. Where they differed from punk was that, or to the punk ethos, was that they could actually do they respected the roots of the music as well. They respected rock and roll. They respected rhythm and blues. They respected elements that were even outside of that, like jazz and filtering around with classical music and so on. They respected music. And the punk ethos was that you didn't. I mean, they fitted. And then, of course, when post-punk came along, the new wave, and you were talking about Ian Dury and Elvis Costello and people who weren't particularly punks, but they rode that boom. They fitted into that much more because they were kind of they had the sort of punk dynamic, but with much more creative sensibilities, you know. So that kind of post-punk new wave thing, I think they influenced. And obviously they influenced the dreaded progressive rock, which occurred in parallel. But, you know, because Pete Townsend does a mini opera, or we can all do that, and you've got these things like Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds and all these kind of flamboyant, it's a nonsense. Well, that's my opinion. But you know what I'm saying? So you got all that on the back of it, that it kind of like it legitimized it, if you like, in terms of rock with a capital R, because Tommy was so marvelous, you know, the album and Quadrophenia, and the Quadrophenia movie, of course, which was like, unlike the Tommy movie, was much more of the spirit of the original album, you know. I mean, in fact, that's what people remember now about Quadrophenia, is those images. Of the movie, you know.
When you write a book and you do a deep dive into the history of an act or an artist or whatever you're doing, and in this case, looking back at The Who, listening to all their albums, going really into, you know, looking at old interviews, looking at everything about them, you make a discovery for yourself that you hadn't had before. What discovery did you make about The Who, which was new to you?
I had reminders. I'd forgotten, to be honest, and this sounds very simple, I'd forgotten how good that first album was. And honestly, because you're with a great band, there's a kind of assumption that the next album is better than, or it's more developed, or what have you know what I mean? But you go back to and then you go, bloody hell. I mean, if you go back to Please Please Me Now, the Beatles' first album, it's so good. It's like, and it's recorded in a day, but it's just so good on it in its own right, regardless of how technically simple it was. And that first album of theirs is terrific. But on a broader scale, what I discovered was that the converse of that they, and particularly Pete Townsend, was far more broad-based in their creativity than one immediately thinks. You know, you think of, oh, they're the mod band that got clever. They did Tommy, that was wonderful. They did Quadrophenia, that was right. Blah, blah, blah. But then when you go into it in retrospect, there was a lot more going on, particularly with Townsend's input. It's a pleasant surprise, you know.
Well, Mike Evans, with the book The Who, Much Too Much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And for me, I've been a sort of superficial Who fan. I know all the milestones along the way. Yeah. So for me, it was a really exciting read, and to find out something new about the band along the way was a great journey and trip for me. Thank you very much.
That's the satisfying thing about books like this.
We made USAA insurance to help you save. Take advantage of discounts when you cover your home and your ride. Discover how we're helping members save at usaa.com/bundle. USAA. Restrictions apply.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.